This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast, brought to you by BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and a warm welcome to Outdoors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen and he's Ewan McElrath.
I was very fortunate. I was brought up in Sutherland. My father was a great ornithologist, Desmond Nethersall Thompson. In fact, he was the first ornithologist in the world to write books about four different bird species. So my first experience was at the age of three, being dragged over peatland to see a black-throated diver's nest, which is actually a very rare bird. And I cried the whole time. Absolutely not with happiness. I was cold and I was hungry, but I do remember it vividly. And that really was the beginning of my contact with nature.
But that call of the diver is just so evocative of the Highlands. I mean, that's a good place to start.
It's a wonderful place to start. And we were so lucky, because as part of my father's research, we'd take off to North Sutherland, to Northwest Sutherland, up below Foynovan, Cranstackie. And a family of eight would sleep in a hut about 10 foot by 12 foot for 6 weeks every year from 1964 to 1982. The hut was by a river. It was a fishing hut, so you'd have this lovely sound of the river. One thing you learn about a river is every night it sounds different. Mm-hmm. It's a very dynamic body. And we were there to study greenshanks. So we were in raw contact with greenshanks and golden plovers and golden eagles and peregrines. But the lifestyle was amazing. If you've been in the Highlands in May, pouring rain, sometimes a family of eight, my mother breastfeeding the smallest one, no sanitation at all, running water was outside.
Come on.
Exactly, literally. Yeah. And we'd be cooped up together sometimes for a whole week, but then you'd have these breaks in the cloud. And as kids, we used to shout out blue sky. Mm-hmm. Blue sky and golden eagle, these were the two things we used to shout out.
Is that not enough to put you off wildlife forever?
People have often said that to me, and remarkably, with the exception of my youngest sister, who now lectures in law in Leicester, the rest of us have a real affinity for nature. Mm-hmm. But it was also an affinity for people. Not just for the family, but we absolutely devour any information we could get from people walking down the glen. We were 4 miles from the road, so subsisting off tinned food. And my mother, sometimes heavily pregnant, would have to walk up the hill, catch the bus, go into Durness and collect stores. And this was all part of this experience.
When you talk about, you know, we were there to study greenshanks, not at 3 years old you weren't. So, but you know, at what stage did your father actually put you into harness?
Four. So we would go out, and it was a real treat to go out with them. Greenshank, it's a fascinating bird. It's one of the toughest birds' nests to find. It's an elusive bird. It nests in very stony landscape, and you've got to watch them very carefully to find the nests. Virtually nothing was known about them before he started the study, and he ended up producing two great books on the birds. So you go out in the evening, and you've got to see the bird flying into the nest. So you're sitting for hours waiting for this bird to come in. It often comes in silently. It might just chip once or twice, flits down onto the nest, and as it goes onto the nest, the other bird goes off for a 10-hour shift of feeding. So if you miss that, you're done for a day. And with the weather conditions, you've possibly only got two or three more days left in order to find the nest.
Was he doing that as a scientist or as an amateur ornithologist?
He was a scientist. So he got funding from the Leverhulme Research Foundation. Then he got Natural Environment Research Council funding, so formal research funding. And as I got much older, I was able to write up some of this work in scientific papers. And of course, he produced his books. So he was funded in terms of his research expenses. And we were his field assistants. So in the end, we were going out, ringing the birds. Not unusual to be walking 20, 25 miles a day, chasing after these birds, going to different nests. My little sister, Mimi, she would regularly clock up 30 miles in a day, supremely fit. She became a cross-country champion, but living in this amazing landscape.
Explain something to me. I can understand enjoying sitting out in the countryside. I can enjoy sitting watching birds and things. It's the bit I don't get is the collection of data. And the analysis of the data and then writing it up and everything, that would have no appeal to me at all.
It's actually fascinating. My father found that very difficult because he was a great writer, but he wasn't a great analyst. So he had to get help with that. And we had some great people at Aberdeen University, George Dunnett in particular, a very distinguished ecologist, and Adam Watson and Derek Ratcliffe helped him. But then when you see the sort of results emerging, we realised after about 20 years that April soil conditions were determining when the birds bred. May conditions determined how successfully they bred. June determined how many birds would return 2 years later. And that sort of discovery, really very exciting to sort of develop insights into the birds. But what really gets you going is being out there, often on your own, in this sort of wonderful, bleak, wild landscape. Mm-hmm. And you hear the black-throated diver, as you say, the red-throated diver. Golden eagles. I mean, we got so close to golden eagles. Some of us, being very young, we were sort of afraid of golden eagles, actually, on occasion, because they were hunting.
Yeah. But that, as Mark was saying, that analysis, when your dad was doing it and when you were younger, I mean, I can remember my early days at university. You go out in the field, and it was great. You got all the data. And you put it into a huge computer the size of a small city.
Yes.
And you wait 3 weeks before it came back.
Yes. Absolutely. And I mean, I was fortunate. I went on to take my degree at Paisley College, which was fantastic, complete contrast to Sutherland, you know, really heavily populated area, and then took my PhD at Nottingham. And exactly as you're saying, we had the Cripps Computer Centre, and you would wait for hours for these big, huge printouts to come out. In fact, I remember the computer punch cards. And then you'd find you'd made a mistake. So you had to start all over again. And then, you know, 3 or 4 days later, you'd get the revised graph. Painstaking work.
But it's a real mix of, because I remember I was doing ecology and you did biology.
Yes.
But you also had to study statistics.
Yes.
And I was a complete anathema. I don't have anything to do with that. I want to go and do wildlife. I want to do nature.
I know, but I was very fortunate because after I got my PhD, I spent a year in a psychology department where I taught statistics. And that was a huge advantage. And we were surrounded by a lot of data strippers. People love data, actually. Often people who don't work in the field just like to use other people's data. I was different. I love that interaction with nature, thinking about what's going on. It's all about curiosity, frankly. That's what's at the root of it. Curious about nature and trying to discover what's going on.
So you were always going to be a scientist. There was never an option.
Not really. No, I was very fortunate, and my next brother down, Pat, works for the RSPB, is a very fine upland ecologist. My sister took her PhD in ornithology. My younger brother is a hotel manager, but he's got a great interest in birds. So most of us
went into
that.
A real legacy from your father.
A great legacy from the father, but there was one downside. Because we were in the far north in May, we did appallingly at school. Because it was the sort of, you know, it was the school timetable.
Yeah,
so, I should have been revising my history, my physics and my French, which I failed 3 times. But I did deplorably. And I'd always wanted to go to Aberdeen University, but I didn't have the grades. I'd failed my French, failed my Latin. So I went to Paisley College, and I was so lucky there. It's now the University of West Scotland. But then it was full of people like me who'd not done well enough to go to university.
Because a lot of people won't know that. At that time, you had to have a language to get into a Scottish university. If you didn't have a language, university was banned for you.
But I was so lucky, because I'm a huge believer in the polytechnic system. You had teachers there who had great chips on their shoulders. Many of them wanted to work in universities, but couldn't. You'd got students who didn't quite make it. And by God, what a grounding we got. And I had a professor there, Professor John Smythe, who was actually one of the founding fathers of environmental education in Scotland. And he actually took me under his wing, and a number of other students, Colin Galbraith, one of our most distinguished environmentalists in Scotland. He was 2 years below me. We developed a very close friendship there and met many other people. And in my year, half of the graduates went on to do PhDs. They were so determined.
What took you out of academia?
So I was very fortunate. I taught statistics at Nottingham with my PhD, which was on the flocking behaviour of birds.
And gulls and plovers.
Gulls and plovers, yeah. That's right. Yes. My PhD was published as a textbook. I was taking tutorial classes, and I was a hopeless tutor, because all I wanted to do was blether with the students and not teach them. And you know, I wasn't a psychologist. I could talk to them about statistics, but not much else. But a tutorial group didn't turn up, and I knew there was a university fellowship at Liverpool on the offing. So I used the hour to batter out an application in my Olivetti typewriter, and darn me, I got invited up for an interview. And I went up there for 2 years to study song dialects and corm buntings and the effects of parasites on shrimps. I've had this fascination in parasites. Most of the wildlife you see is parasites. So earthworms are parasites. Shrimps in the burn here are parasites. And the parasites cause the shrimps to swim close to the surface where they're going to be taken by ducks or by fish. And so they complete their life cycle. And because I'd studied flocking behaviour in birds and foraging ecology of lapwings in particular, I was fascinated in this. And I was just about to apply for a research grant to look at the physiology of the parasites, how the parasites actually influence the behaviour of the shrimps, when I heard that there was a job going in the Nature Conservancy Council as mountain and moorland ecologist. And the chief scientist at the time was Derek Ratcliffe, one of our most distinguished ecologists, a family friend, so he used to take me out bird watching on occasion, on many occasions actually. And so I applied for the job. Terrible interview. Really terrible interview. I was, shaking as a leaf, dreadful. Well, he phoned me up 2 days later from a phone box, as you did then. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, the job's yours. I mean, you were hopeless. But
worse than hopeless.
So it's your job if you want it. Yeah. And so that was the turning point for me. I joined as the mountain and moorland ecologist with the Nature Conservancy Council. He became my boss for 3 years. And very unusually, for 2 whole days, he sat me down, just him and me, explaining how upland ecology worked, how upland systems worked. And I've always remembered that for PhD students. It doesn't normally happen when you get a job. You sort of spend a couple of hours, if you're lucky, in a year with your boss.
Was it an easier time? You give the impression it was real, everybody knew each other. It was almost like a kind of big family of ecologists. You got Colin Galbraith, real movers and shakers who knew each other. And then that's why you get the job, because he knows you can do it, not how you can do an interview.
I think there's something in that. I was very fortunate. And actually, Derek and I talked about this a lot afterwards. I think, yes, actually, I was fortunate because I knew my father. But they gave me a really tough time, which is why I was so useless in the interview. But he was the most amazing boss. I mean, this is the person who I have said was the greatest field naturalist in Britain since Charles Darwin, and no one's refuted that.
What made him so great?
He was a great all-rounder. He could look at any landscape and describe all the plants, the invertebrates, and the birds there. You could then name a location to him, he'd close his eyes, and he would describe the wealth of nature that was there. He gave us the founding foundation for nature conservation, the SSSIs, the guidelines that underpin that, the nature conservation philosophy we use, the Nature Conservation Review. He edited that. He wrote books on the peregrine, on the raven. He wrote Highland Flora. He devised the first classification, British upland vegetation, with the late Donald McVean. He was a polymath.
Mm-hmm. Kind of makes you feel a bit inadequate.
Absolutely not. He was actually one of the most modest people you could meet. Part of my apprenticeship was he would take me away for 2 weeks into the field. We spent a huge amount of time in the flow country. So, you know, I had to ask him as my boss. This was my CPD, as they call it now, you know, your professional development. And each day we would go out into the field and he would explain how peatlands operate, and we'd be surveying the birds. A lot of the work which eventually gave us the special protection areas we have in the flow country now.
In academia, famously, you have to deal with politics with a small p. Nature Conservancy Council, you're now having to deal with politics with a big p. How big a difference was that?
It was horrendous. I mean, because I was involved in the Nature Conservancy Council, and Derek was the prime architect of nature conservation, and he fell out with the foresters. I mean, he led, along with our then chairman, Sir William Wilkinson, the charge against forestry in the flow country. The day after Derek retired, it was announced that the NCC would be dismembered. I mean, that's the sort of influence he had.
So he had effectively protected it. It had been under his wing.
He had protected it. He and Sir William Wilkinson, and they knew once he was out of the way. I mean, there was a huge amount of engineering behind this. Nature Conservancy Council Scotland was established for 1 year, whilst English Nature was formed, and the Countryside Council for Wales. And then we had Scottish Natural Heritage under a completely new leadership. Roger Crofts, very dear friend now, founder, chief exec, and Magnus Magnusson, the chairman, a most exceptional person. I mean, a great naturalist, but as a communicator, yes, as a politician, yeah, as an operator, as a professional, he had a very profound influence on the way I operated, actually.
But there was a lot of genuine concern when it was disbanded. There was a lot of people saying, this is the end, you know, the bad guys have won here.
Oh, I mean, this went up to Cabinet. You know, Margaret Thatcher had the final say on this. Nicholas Ridley and Malcolm Rifkin were the sort of key proponents of this. I mean, NCC had gotten in the way of too many developments, and we weren't able to articulate the arguments that I think were much better now. So it was political. For me, it was a baptism of fire, and sort of moving into this new environment, bringing the Countryside Commission for Scotland, largely concerned with recreation and landscapes, and the nature conservationists together. The nature conservationist ethos of we know best, and preaching to others how to manage the land, which isn't really very effective. You've got to listen, learn, and talk to people in a conversational way. So those early days were very difficult. And Magnus and Roger between them deserve a huge amount of credit. I mean, the work that Magnus did in leading the Cairngorms Working Party, I mean, I revisited the report recently. That's a fantastic piece of writing and thinking. And that laid the foundations for first the Cairngorms Partnership and then the Cairngorms National Park.
Not only that, I remember speaking to Magnus as a very baby reporter. I asked him, what's the future? He said, the future is under the waves. The future for Scotland's heritage is at sea.
Mm.
And and that's happening now, decades later. You know, that's where we've got to.
Yes, no, absolutely. And when we started out, we had we spent £14,000 in 1 year on marine surveys. We had a deep dive submersible that we kept on losing. I mean, when you look now at what we know about the seas, it is absolutely fantastic. The work that my own colleagues are doing in Marine Scotland, I mean, the discoveries that are being made are phenomenal.
Taking you back to something you said earlier, where the trouble is environmentalists, a lot of them took their lead from John Muir, you know, and you have this sort of Old Testament sort of prophet figure. Fascinating, always worth listening to, not always comfortable to be with, and it doesn't make for the best form of communication. You've kind of got to talk to people on their level.
Well, you do, and so that's one of the things that Magnus taught me and others. Magnus always said, talk to the people, connect with the people. It's interesting, we talk now about connecting people in nature. That's what we have to do. Magnus was one of the forerunners, one of the instigators of that. If you can't communicate, you're not going to get anywhere. One of the things that gives me great hope is I mentioned Magnus and the role he's had, and we do have new leadership, younger leadership in SNH now. I mean, Francesca Ososka, our new chief executive, is a force for nature. I mean, she is
force from, of nature.
She is a force of and for nature, yeah. And the sort of climate she's creating in SNH, shortly to be Nature Scot, is fantastic. It is about connecting people and nature. It is about creating a platform for nature, a natural platform for nature, and devising natural solutions. The climate emergency, these problems we have with carbon emissions, will only be solved by restoring our peatlands, restoring our coast, and taking in hand a whole manner of other things to try and lock up carbon, make the landscape more vibrant, much healthier. So I am very optimistic. And I'm especially optimistic because of the younger generation. Youngsters who are so important now, and they are in the right place. When I was a student, you know, I was out selling socialist worker and complaining about all manner of things, but I wasn't actually protesting about the state of the environment. Now, we've got, you know, Young Scot, a fantastic organisation, leading the clarion cry for a healthier environment. And that gives me huge hope.
That was the Scotland Outdoors podcast brought to you by BBC Radio Scotland. If you enjoyed it, please pass it on to a friend if you wouldn't mind. And if you've got the time, like us or review us. It just helps us spread the net a little wider.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.